And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and today we're going to talk about Ukraine / Crimea. There's a brand new world developing, and we're going to have to adjust or learn and keep our wits about us, and maybe be a little bit demanding of people called our leaders. And we're going to begin with an interview we did with Murray Dobbin, and following Murray Dobbin, who's written a great piece in Taiyi on Ukraine, Crimea, etc., we'll be talking with Anne Garrison in Berkeley. She has won the International Women's Network for Democracy and Peace. An award has been given to Anne Garrison for her excellent reporting on the matter of Victoire Ingabire in Rwanda. So that won't surprise our regular listeners. Let's begin with Murray Dobbin. You can go to murraydobbin.ca if you want to go get the straight goods without any admixture. Of course, Murray is also seen in Taiyi and in Rabble, and was a columnist with Financial Post and Winnipeg Free Press, and has had a long and distinguished career. Murray, well, thanks very much for joining us. Your piece about the situation in Ukraine couldn't be more timely, and it's the title I have here is What's Really at Stake? And I hope Canadians are really thinking about this, and I suppose my starting point is that there seems to be a phenomenon where we have to be with NATO or with Russia, and sort of divide the house kind of thing, when I don't hear a voice raised about, well, what is the Canadian perspective on how to settle international disputes and what the issues are about. I take it that's part of your issue in the column.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, I end the column saying, you know, we might want to ask, you know, John Baird and Harper, you know, why they're making this idiotic comparison to Nazi Germany. I mean, it's a kind of barroom comparison, right? If you get drunk and someone pisses you off, you compare them to Nazi Germany. I mean, it's such a knee-jerk and amateurish kind of thing to do, mind you.
I thought that had become kind of a laughable notion. As a matter of fact, there's even commentaries now that say that when the name Hitler comes up, you know the argument is, you know, has gone into the street.
Well, that's right. Whoever uses it has lost the argument.
You know? Yeah, that's right. Proof that you've lost.
And of course, Hillary Clinton used it too, and I despise that woman. I think she's awful. So she reveals herself again. But I think, I mean, my sense is that Stephen Harper actually doesn't give a damn about foreign policy, and this is what I say in my column. It's all about votes for Harper, and the title in the in Rabble or in the Taiyi was Harper's Vote Grubbing in Ukraine, which I think is actually, you know, maybe a better title, because that's clearly what he does all the time. His absurd trip to Israel with 200 people with him, almost all of them, you know, pro-Israeli, and maybe a couple of Muslim people on that ridiculous trip to Israel, where he is more pro-Israel than Israel is.
And now he's more pro-Ukraine than Ukraine.
Exactly. I mean, it's all about votes. It has nothing to do with responsible foreign policy. So we don't have a foreign policy anymore. Mm-hmm. Our foreign policy is make sure that Stephen Harper gets another majority. And that's all that matters to Harper, so that, you know, if you want to understand our completely irresponsible foreign policy, that's the way to understand it. I mean, you know, he says, okay, I'll go and visit the new government, which is, of course, chock-a-block with neo-Nazis, and real anti-Semites, right? I mean, the other irony, of course, is that both Harper and Baird have gone on and on about the new anti-Semitism, and of course the new anti-Semitism is basically anyone who criticizes Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So they get extremely agitated by the new anti-Semitism, but apparently they don't care that there's half a dozen or more members of an anti-Semitic and fascist party in this new government. So the whole thing is really, you know, just quite outrageous, but the media in this country is so complicit with this kind of thing and so lazy.
Yes.
that we just don't get we don't get the truth, we don't get the hypocrisy, mm-hmm. we don't get the irony of all of this stuff, and it's really unfortunate because, of course, in a democracy, if you don't have informed citizens, then you don't have a democracy.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Marie Dobbin, who's written a great piece, and it was published on March 11, What's Really at Stake in Ukraine, / Harper's Vote-Grabbing Policy on Ukraine. You know, you raise this issue that there's complicity and laziness, and I agree with that. But I wonder if there might be another phenomenon, which is fear. Are the other parties afraid to talk about issues, which Canadians, we're told, are very concerned about, this issue of the rise of neo-fascism, which, by the way, is spreading, as we now know, across Europe. There are members being elected to the European Parliament.
Absolutely. And
that Parliament, European Parliament, took a position where they said specifically this party, Svoboda, they did not want them to become part of the Ukrainian government. They urged the Ukrainian government not to have them. And this is going back, yeah. not just now, but going back
2 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. So what's the matter with why is it that other people are afraid of losing votes? Why doesn't somebody ask some poignant questions?
That's a very good question, and I despair over the NDP and the Liberals in the House of Commons, because they just both went along with Harper barely. I mean, they had a couple of very muted criticisms, you know, saying, well, maybe he shouldn't have used the comparison with Nazi Germany. But I mean, basically the whole. They just fell over completely, and the NDP and the Liberals have done this consistently, and you know, going right back to the outrageous murder of Muammar Gaddafi and the overthrow of his government, when in fact the UN resolution was limited to a no-fly zone. And so now what you have in Libya, of course, is a totally failed state with militias running, you know, the country divided up into half a dozen little fiefdoms run by radical Muslim militias, and that's what we get. But in the House of Commons, the only person actually who refused to give unanimous consent on Libya was Elizabeth May of the Green Party. So we have just a lot of political cowardice mm-hmm. In the House of Commons, and it's really unfortunate.
Yeah, but unfortunately, in history, when ugly things happen. That's often what, when the historians look at them, they say, well, and meanwhile, the parliaments were talking about this or that, or ducking, or refusing to put things.
Yeah.
It's a curious and really unfortunate moment. Have you been, you would think that someone, for example, might just, you know, looking for an angle how to get this discussed properly, might point out that two of the luminaries of U.S. foreign policy, the biggest names, Brzezinski, Zbig, I guess they call him, and then Kissinger, are actually differing. And Kissinger said this is a silly or phony crisis. It doesn't have to be a problem at all.
Yeah, I hate.
He
to
wrote
agree
a perfectly
with
rational yeah. article.
I know. I sort of hate to agree with a war criminal, but but on this one,
well, we can reduce the sentence.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. We can let him out a day early. But I mean, he says we should treat the Ukraine like Finland. During the whole Cold War period, where Finland was basically recognized on both sides as neutral, because otherwise, I mean, what the West doesn't seem to understand, and yet it clearly does. I mean, it's not lacking in information, is that for Russia, the Ukraine is an existential issue, and for the West to try and bring NATO or bring the Ukrainians to NATO is an existential threat to Russia, and they know this, and yet they still play. I mean, it would be like Russia, trying to get Mexico to change its policies and get out of NAFTA. Mm-hmm. You know, Russia had proposed an economic agreement that would have allowed the Ukraine to have economic relations with the West and with Russia, which is, you know, by far the most sensible thing for everybody. Yes. And yet, it just seems, you know, these guys are like 5-year-olds, which is a insult to 5-year-olds. They cannot, they simply don't seem to be able to develop a rational response to international events. And of course, the level of hypocrisy coming from the United States is just stunning. I mean, every illegal act that the United States has done over the last 50 years.
Well, people were passing out on the street hearing the Secretary Kerry say, this isn't the 19th century. You don't invade countries on
with
a false...
on a trumped-up charge. I mean, I know. Like,
people kind of keeled over.
I know. I think we need to offer all these guys lessons in irony, right? I don't think, Americans don't get irony, right? I mean, it's one of the casualties of being an empire.
Well, do you remember that when, I think it was during the Reagan period, that various people who were right-wing pundits in America said irony is dead.
Yeah,
they did. They said no more. We will not allow any more irony. No more your smirks.
I know. It's just it's stunning that he could actually say that without something in his brain going, oh, this might not sound so good.
Yeah.
I know, it's just...
But by the way, that does seem to be a tribute to his personal gifts, that he could actually maintain a straight face.
Yes.
And also his interlocutor. I only saw the clip. I don't know whether the guy keeled over himself or if he put to him the problem. But that it is a... people do know the word Kosovo. U.S. was quite happy to say, yes, that's part of Serbia. No, it's not part of Serbia. A vote's good enough, and we'll bomb you if you don't like it.
Yes, yeah, and all this talk about this aggressive invasion without a shot fired. And what about Iraq, where 500,000 people died? I mean, it's just unbelievable over this, their trumped-up, weapons of mass destruction rationale. Mm-hmm. And so, and Kosovo... is a very good parallel. The other thing is, I mean, how can you possibly deny people when they vote 90%? They couldn't even find anybody on the street who was voting who wanted to stay in the Ukraine.
Well, why would they?
How can you possibly deny, when 90% of the people want to make a decision on independence? I mean, even if it was technically illegal or technically not a perfect referendum. I mean, it's absurd. Imagine if we tried to stop Quebec and they voted 90% for independence and we tried to stop them.
You couldn't argue. The people made little attempts of, oh, they're intimidated. But no, I mean, anybody with a sense of history or had been listening for a century or so would say, no, well, of course, these people are Russian. They've been with the Russia, and now they have a government that says it doesn't like Russians. I mean,
right.
what do you think would happen?
Right. I mean, it passes legislation that eliminates Russian as a second language. They ban the party.
The people who voted for the president that they illegally removed were these people.
Yeah.
I mean, after all, their president's gone, and then somebody called the prime minister is ordering them to do something. Why would they do that?
I know.
I hope, would not do that.
No. Well, there's so many outrageous things about this. And I remember before I actually sort of delved into it and did a lot of reading about this, I'm sitting watching TV, and we're seeing cops lit on fire with firebombs, and basically Roman candles completely engulfed in flames, and the commentator talking about the brutality of the police. I'm going, wait a minute. If that happened here, imagine if the United States, a cop was covered with gasoline. There's absolutely no doubt they would shoot to kill.
Oh, absolutely.
And they didn't. I mean, for a week, Ukrainian police were unarmed on the street, and they were being brutalized. And you notice all the demonstrators, or the demonstrators fighting with the police, they were in brand new army fatigues. They had helmets. They had body armor. They had iron pipes and baseball bats. I'm sorry. Yeah. This is not a demonstration.
No, and by the way, they had shoulder patches identifying them as being with the right sector people.
That's right, the right sector movement. And where did they get the money? I mean, the West's fingerprints are all over this, and right from the beginning, well, you had American politicians going and egging them on, basically.
Speaking
saying,
in Maidan Square.
Yeah, being, you have to be more militant. It's unbelievable. It's crazy making watching this stuff and not having anything close to a reasonably accurate coverage of what is actually going on.
Yeah, no, that is the frightening part. We're speaking to Murray Dobbin, and is the article is in Taiyi, and of course you can also go to murraydobbin.ca, and it's what's really at stake in Ukraine. And Murray, I want to ask you this. I don't understand the coverage on this aspect. When the president, Yanukovych, was considering what to do with the offer from the EU, which, by the way, was a kind of exclusive deal. It's like you're going to be a McDonald's franchise and you're not going to sell anything else.
That's right.
And you'll do what we tell you to do. And he thought about it. And, of course, he represents this oddly teetering east-west country. And he says, I don't think I want to go with that one. I think I want to go with this other one. When did all of our parties, Liberal and NDP, BQ, Green, when did they all decide that they liked EU proposals and they liked the EU austerity and all that goes with taking direction from the International Monetary Fund? You recall we had big demonstrations here, by the way, everybody got roughed up and kettled and everything else. But clearly people here are not very impressed with the way the G8, G20 does business. Why wasn't there any compassion or saying, well, maybe he's got a point?
Well, yeah, that's a very good question. What most people don't realize was just how provocative that agreement with the Ukraine was. I mean, and I go back to the point that, you know, Ukraine is unique in terms of its relationship with Russia. No other former East Bloc country has the same sort of existential connection with Russia that the Ukraine does. And so what does the West do? It offers an economic deal that essentially isolates Russia and offers, not only that, but offers a military integration clause in the agreement, which in effect would be, although not officially part of NATO, would, you know, you'd have a military alignment with the West in a country that is so close in with Russia in terms of its history. It just was completely provocative. It's almost and I also point out, I mean, why would they? It just makes no sense that they would provoke Russia in this way. I mean, Russia actually has been an ally of the United States. It allowed the United States to use its airspace in its invasion of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Russia spends a huge amount of money on anti-terrorism and cooperates with the U.S. on that, and basically they're saving the U.S. in Syria. You know, it was Russia's proposal to get rid of the chemical weapons. Basically saved Obama from himself, and they're also key to what's going on in terms of the negotiations to make sure that Iran doesn't have nuclear weapons. So here's the United States relying on Russia in all these areas, and all of a sudden it seems to be deliberately provoking it. It's just mind-boggling, actually.
Yeah. Well, by the way, that really gets me to a subject which I wanted to ask you about, too, and this Murray Dobbin, and that is that we seem to actually have a kind of virus that I would have to call Russophobia. What is the material basis for disliking Russians? Putin is, we know what he's up to. He's an old KGB guy. Well, I guess Catherine the Great was the KGB, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, I think we are really captive to our media a lot of the time. And I think there's that, you know, and you now hear the phrase that, you know, the revival of the Cold War and all of this stuff, you know. I just think that, you know, people, you know, don't have the time, I guess, to really delve into this. I mean, all this stuff is there if you want to look for it. You can go to the Independent, you can go to the Guardian, you can go to, you know, other websites that actually have this story. But
yeah, the internet, God bless it, will save you if you want the information.
But you have to put the effort in, and you know, most people are just too busy to do that, you know, every time some story breaks. So it's difficult, but you're right. I mean, at least it's there. Yeah. And, you know, all you have to do is go to, you know, Google Ukraine and fascism, and you get 180 stories, you know,
yeah,
or more.
Well, now we're getting, and but incidentally, I mean, again, I think there's a starting point for any healthy democracy such as ours, as we're told, is that they would say, okay, you seem to be in a turbulent situation. We're sympathetic to you if you don't want to be under the thumb of Russia. However, we have a problem with people who are seem to be sympathetic to National Socialism, certainly have racist and anti, who are homophobic, they are linguistic nationalists. And such people, if you want our confidence, you can't put those people in your government.
Exactly.
By the way, they didn't win a big portion. Mr. Yanukovych beat them rather handily, these right-wing parties.
Well, they got very small percentages.
So why are they in government? Why is it necessary? And by the way, what about disarming them? I thought we have a paradox. First of all, they're peaceful, nonviolent, and have no weapons. But now we have a problem that nobody can get the weapons away from them.
Yes, right. And they've set up this whole new civil defense organization. It just sounds like the brown shirts to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and not only are they are the people who are joining this this new civil so-called civil defense group are members of the right sector and the Svoboda Party. But they also have their own guns, like you say. I mean, where did they get these guns? I mean, who paid for them? You know, all these questions, and there's no investigation into it. Just as there's no investigation into the claim now that the demonstrators who were slaughtered on that one day were killed by snipers hired by or part of right sector.
Mm-hmm.
And so that just disappears. There's no investigation.
Yes.
Why wouldn't the West say, okay, there seems to be some serious charges here? Let's investigate, see who actually did the killing. And the fact that 27 policemen were killed is virtually never mentioned in the mainstream media.
No, absolutely. And I guess another twist to this, I want to mention it, that I was reading the German press, and they sound like reluctant soldiers. I know that they're toying the line, but, you know, Putin and Merkel were on the phone, and according to the German press, she agreed with Putin that, yes, there should be an investigation of what happened there,
mm-hmm,
on the 22nd of February.
Right.
And that also there should be a contact group. And, you know, in other words, let's not get this too tense. There should be,
right,
a contact group where each brings their problem with the other to the table in an honest way. But all this is being pushed aside by Mr. Obama and this person, Nuland, who's a very right-wing Republican, she,
right,
and her husband. American foreign policy is really scary when the cover comes off and you see that Nuland is the point person.
Right.
And it seems, well, to go back to Germany, it seems to me that you can see signs that in Central Europe they're not so enthusiastic about this policy.
No, I think it makes everyone really nervous because, you know, the potential for someone making a mistake, you know,
and who will pay?
Goes on, and who will pay? Yeah, it's just simple mindedness in terms of it's like kids playing war, you know, without any subtlety and no investigation of any of these elements,
mm-hmm,
that are going on. Why wouldn't they say to the Ukraine, okay, well, we will give you aid, but you have to, you know, clear the Nazis out of your government.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't they say that? I mean,
exactly.
They would have to do that. How else could they proceed? I mean,
they're desperate
for help.
If we were to, all the European states have been talking about this concern of the rise of fascism and xenophobia, attacks on the Roma people, mm-hmm, threats against Jews. Some of Jews have been attacked, and Hungarian minority, etc. They've said we don't want. It should be agreed in Europe that these parties who are advocating these things will not be in governments.
Yeah.
So why can't it be brought back to that point and just say, you know, no hard feelings, but you can't have these people in your government.
Yeah, you can have one or both. You can
but
have
we don't have any. I don't know of an elected voice in Canada that would that I could imagine standing up and asking that question.
I know. It's really it's really discouraging. And I think, well, part of the problem with the NDP, I mean, I think there might be people in the caucus, but most people don't realize how much of a control freak the leader of the NDP is. It used to be, you know, you'd hear people comment on foreign policy like Libby Davies, you know, would comment quite often on Israel and the Palestinian issue. Well, she hasn't said a single word since Mulcair came to power, because he has implemented a rule that the only people who can speak on foreign policy would be the foreign policy critic, and the only person who can speak on Medicare is the Medicare critic. And so you've got a situation in which you know the NDP members who might actually have a contrary view are not allowed to speak.
Yeah.
And so the likelihood of anyone from that party now, you know, saying a critical word about anything is reduced almost to zero.
Yeah, it really does makes you we ought to re-examine what parliaments are supposed to be and do. I mean, here in Toronto, some of us feel that Olivia Chow has been liberated to actually be a human being again. We're all very happy about that. Because otherwise you go off to Parliament and people can't even remember who that was.
I know. No. Well, I think, you know, I mean, you know, I've been contemplating doing another column and entitling it "The NDP is Dead, Long Live the NDP." And, you know, the notion that I think we're clearly looking, you know, at a situation where we need another party. I think the NDP is now compromised itself so much in terms of moving to the center and beyond the center that you really have to question whether this party can actually deliver and give people hope in terms of the incredible crises that we face. I mean, there's going to be another economic meltdown. What's the NDP saying about this? Nothing. It just says nothing, and it has virtually nothing to say about climate change except a couple of you know, minor policies. It ever since Jack Layton decided that the NDP was going to try to win an election, they've been moving rapidly to the right. And of course,
how to win an election? Be Stephen Harper.
Yeah, or be Justin Trudeau. But of course, you can't be Justin Trudeau.
Yeah.
So you know,
he belongs to another party.
Yeah, people are going to look at these parties in 2015, and they're going to say, "Well, what's the best way of getting rid of Stephen Harper?" And they might have at one point voted for the NDP, because at least if the NDP held the balance of power, they'd, you know, have some progressive policies. But that won't even be true. I mean, you've got, you know, Mulcair saying he will never, ever, full stop, raise personal income taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Not even on the wealthy. Yeah. Wow. So how do you do anything if you don't have any money, right? I mean, it's just, it's a bit crazy-making. You can't, I mean, we're now, every year, we are $50 billion short of revenue because of liberal and conservative tax cuts, and yet Mulcair refuses to address that question of basically a revenue crisis.
Yeah, it's like he found the Tony Blair playbook in a garbage can and said, "Oh boy, this would really work." And it might have about 20 years ago.
Yeah,
and of course it led to the monster called Tony Blair. By the way, I mean, and thank goodness you wrote a great column, you know, the NDP needs big ideas. At least they got a rise out of them, and they wrote back and said, "We do have big ideas, we just don't want to talk about it."
Yeah. and they don't have big ideas. That's the problem. They don't even understand what...
Well, the big idea was socialism. Tommy Douglas was...
He had the big idea.
He stood on a, you know, that box, and he said, "I'm for Medicare."
Yeah, Medicare was a big idea.
And now every Canadian says, "So am I."
Yeah, exactly. No, they've completely lost touch with. They don't even know what a big idea is. So that's my next column. Actually, is to explain what a big idea is. See if there's any resonance.
Yeah.
With that.
Well, this is Murray Dobbin, and boy, we're really glad we could talk to you, Murray. It is excellent column. I bet you've been getting a rise out of people. I know that every time I discuss this subject, there's a degree of temperature that goes up, but it's got to be addressed. I mean, we're now looking at NATO moving towards the Russian border and people starting to break out all the old hardware. This is not a good idea.
No, it's my generation and yours hasn't been through, you know, a sort of European wars, but you can see how they can start by accident, just by pure stupidity.
Yes.
And by bad judgment, you know, I mean, you know, if this actually comes to any kind of armed conflict, it will have been completely unnecessary.
Yeah.
You know, done by recklessly bad judgment, with no discernible purpose in mind.
Yeah. And speaking with Murray Dobbin, thank you very, very much, Murray, and we look forward to your next column.
Yes, sir, and happy to come on anytime you like.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Did you know you can listen to CIUT 5 different ways?